This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on October 8th. Thanks to everyone who donated to Co-op's fall membership drive. In case you missed it, it's never too late to go to coop.org and hit the donate button. Although the specific circumstances of the homeless might be different, the structural inequities that predispose people to bouts of homelessness have much in common. From the website for Ending Community Homelessness Coalition in Austin, or ECHO, the true number of people experiencing homelessness is difficult to determine because people fall into and exit from homelessness all the time. However, there are ways to approximate the size of Austin's homeless population. The point in time, or PIT count, is an annual survey of the homeless population in Austin-Travis County that provides a snapshot of the number of people experiencing homelessness on one particular night, this year, January 25th. In 2020, the PIT count identified 2,506 individuals. 932 were sheltered, 1,574 unsheltered. This figure increased 11% from 2019. Black residents make up more than 35%, even though blacks make up less than 10% of the general population of Austin. Causes of homelessness include lack of affordable housing. A minimum wage worker in Austin would have to work 125 hours per week to afford a one-bedroom apartment. Lack of affordable health care, forcing people to choose between health and housing. Trauma, often due to an abusive relationship. Racial inequality, barriers due to background checks and historic redlining. Challenges while homeless include legal issues resulting in fines and incarceration. Violence, being attacked or beaten up while experiencing homelessness. Health issues, including chronic diseases, disabilities, and mental health. Lack of fulfillment, no activities that bring them happiness. And basic needs such as food, water, and bathing. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. We have two guests this evening, both familiar voices on this program. Gus Bova is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. He covers homelessness, labor, immigration, and border issues, among other topics. And we're also joined by Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Austin regularly covers city council, in addition to a variety of other civic and social concerns. And we have our regular commentator, Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Michelle Manning Scott is away, working for the Travis County Clerk through Election Day. If you're hand-delivering your mail-in ballot, there's a good chance you'll meet her. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs, Gus and Austin. How you guys doing?
About as well as can be.
Yeah, glad to be working, but still kind of stressful, you know?
Yeah, this pandemic just doesn't quit. Although I heard the news that governor's planning to open the bars.
Can't wait to have a celebratory drink.
Right, and he's even somehow failed to please the bar lobby, I guess.
Yeah, I saw a press release. They were attacking him, that he's not really doing anything.
Uh-huh. Gus, your story, No Place to Be, was published just a few weeks ago. It's an amazing work of in-depth journalism that covers what you call a 30-year war on homelessness. What led you to write that?
Basically, as your listeners are probably aware, you know, homelessness has been this hot button issue in Austin for about a year and a half now, give or take. I mean, it kind of ebbed and flowed to some degree, but more or less it's stayed in the news since last June, when the city didn't even exactly repeal, just sort of loosened and modified laws targeting behaviors homeless folks have to do to survive, right? And there was a lot of heat and not so much light, I would say. A lot of misinformation, you know, mostly coming from the right wing, basically people trying to seize on a political opportunity here and spreading misinformation and smears about the homeless community and so forth. And so the first thing I wanted to do, which Austin also did, and some journalists certainly did, was to just go out into the unhoused community and talk directly to them and tell stories through that lens instead of through this sort of superficial back and forth between Abbott and city council, where frankly both sides sort of gloss over the truth in different ways. And once I'd done that, I was thinking, what else, if anything, can I add? And so, I mean, as usual, I was just kind of trying to follow my own questions, which were, one, you know, if some people are acting like modifying these ordinances is the end of the world, well, not every city has these ordinances. Austin must have passed them at a certain time for a certain reason in a certain context. So I'll go down that rabbit hole. And then I figured while I was at it, I would just kind of learn about the origins of homelessness in America in general, which obviously I'm not the first person to look into that, but you'd be surprised. There's not that many histories of homelessness in America out there. I read a couple of the only books out there that actually take that as their subject. For me, it was just changed my whole perspective mentally thinking about the issue when I learned that basically the modern homelessness crisis is just a 40-year-old phenomenon.
Right. You go into that. You think about homelessness and in history, and at least in my mind, it takes me back to the Great Depression, you know, with the bread lines or soup lines. You know, we had FDR was able to take that on with the New Deal. But as you point out, really post-World War II in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, certainly in the depths of the Great Depression, there was mass homelessness. Some of it of the sort of Grapes of Wrath variety, some of it of other varieties. But basically the New Deal and sort of the, you know, the post-World War II boom in America as well, turned it into a very small, rare phenomenon, mostly older men in what they called Skid Row districts of cities. The historian that I cited, Kenneth Kuzmer, he did the work of actually like reviewing the disparate kinds of records that exist for different periods of American history. And his claim was that in the mid 20th century in America, the rate of homelessness was the lowest since the mid 18th century. The last time homelessness was that low was when we were a mostly agrarian society, right? And what that proves in my mind is basically that economic conditions and housing policy can dramatically reduce, if not end, homelessness. And it's just funny because I think sometimes it's seen as such an intractable problem. Right.
Yeah. I really liked the term you used. You were talking about the 1980s. And I think the phrase was a brutal confluence of economic trends, the destruction of cheap housing, and Reagan era austerity.
Yeah. There's basically three things. There's the sort of like, and this is sort of a global economic shift in the 70s, right? The time when America really starts rapidly deindustrializing, puts a ton of stress shoving well-paid working class folks down into the ranks of poverty. But at the same time, and really for years before then, urban renewal has been going on, which basically amounts to bulldozing affordable urban housing around the country. And then that just kind of dovetails with the explicit Nixon and Reagan policies of just gutting all federal housing assistance. And you get what you think you would get. Right? That's kind of the point I'm trying to make, you know?
it seems so obvious, and it really is, that like one way to reduce unsheltered homelessness is to provide more affordable housing, to create more housing opportunities. And part of the reason why that's such an obvious solution is because one thing you'll learn talking to people providing services to people experiencing homelessness is the earlier you can intervene before they hit the streets, the less expensive and easier it is to stabilize their housing. And that's why, you know, this task force report that the city council commissioned that was just released a couple of months ago, it really emphasized that rapid rehousing, which is kind of like a short-term housing stabilization. You kind of like help someone pay the rent for a few months or something like that. That's like the most efficient, effective way of reducing homelessness because it's really preventative. If someone's facing eviction, you help them stay in their home. They are not evicted and they never become homeless in the first place. I think that kind of gets lost sometimes. Like Gus said, that homelessness seems like an intractable problem, but the solutions are really there and pretty obvious to some degree. So I think it's kind of important to emphasize that part of the overall strategy.
Sure. You know, prevent it from happening.
And to touch on what you were mentioning, these ordinances such as camping bans, they came around in a certain time period, basically nationwide. Again, if you go back to the idea that the modern homelessness crisis emerged in the 80s, and then we failed to address the crisis. And so as it wore on, cities, with the help of certain advocacy groups, turned to a punitive approach in the early 90s. And you have a lot of cities, especially smaller ones, that are still just now passing policies like this. But the big first wave came in the early 90s, and that's when Austin passed its camping ban. The other two ordinances came about 7 years later. It was two things. One, this crisis was not being addressed. We don't solve something sort of on the back end through social and economic policy. You start to turn to a criminal justice punitive approach. And secondarily, it also coincided with the revitalization of a lot of urban cores, a lot of downtowns. Basically, as everyone knows, there was white flight and suburbanization for much of the middle part of the last century. And that created a huge investment opportunity over time in downtowns, but there were a lot of unhoused folks hanging around downtown, depressing the real estate values. So that was another push there.
You know, it was about that time, I guess the late 80s, early 90s, when we saw a couple major homeless shelters established in Austin. The Salvation Army, I think, was the first one. The city itself put together this ARCH, what is it, Austin Resource Center for the Homeless. What's also interesting is almost coinciding with that was when these opposition groups began to form. You talk about different ones, Gus, DAR, DAA. I don't remember what those stand for.
That's the downtown business lobby, basically. That's the group that's pushing to establish more businesses and more nightlife downtown. But ultimately, it's kind of about raising the real estate values downtown. And it forms in the early 90s, and they basically they're able to form a special district that gives them a taxing authority. They can use that to fund their own kind of private pseudo law enforcement to crack down on the homeless. They are the main lobbying group pushing for the camping ban. They later push for the other bans. You know, not to skip ahead too much, it was interesting that the current DAA today is, you know, keeping a degree of distance between itself and the real fervently anti-homeless groups in town, like Save Austin Now and Take Back Austin. I think that to some degree, they've been won over to sort of the city's approach to the issue. But historically, they were the main lobbying force behind these punitive approaches.
Yeah, Gus, that was something that I was really interested to read in your story as someone who's been covering like the contemporary Downtown Austin Alliance and has talked to Bill Bryce a few times, especially when the ordinances were amended last year, how their stance has changed really. You know, in my conversations with Bill, I feel like he has been given his role as someone promoting like the downtown way of life has been more understanding, I think, of what the city was doing, certainly more than leaders at the Austin Police Association or the Travis County Republican Party, who, you know, have no qualms with really demonizing people experiencing homelessness. I never really picked up that from Bill, but I don't remember the former president's name that you interview for the story. He certainly, you know, talks of the way that the Save Austin Now people do. So that was an interesting contrast.
Well, and then moving ahead in the chronology, we're into the 90s. And Gus, you mentioned a few books on homelessness. We had a little email exchange about Lars Eichner. Probably his groundbreaking book was titled Travels with Lisbeth. I remember reading that in the 90s. There was a whole chapter in there on dumpster diving. I was just marveling at it because it was all about basic nutrition, you know, where to find decent food in dumpsters. You know, I can't remember all the details, but one of them, in one place that was just a real treasure trove for nutrition, was in the UT area because students were so wasteful, whole pizzas would be thrown out. I remember as I was reading it, just thinking, I don't know if a book like this even exists, if anybody's ever written something like this before.
Yeah, it's a great book. I really couldn't recommend it enough. And it was like a bestseller when it came out in 93 or something.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I had never heard of it until I was researching for this story. But it's not a book that I read just because I was doing homework and researching. It's genuinely an incredibly entertaining memoir of homelessness in Austin and California. And he's still around. I never got around to trying to talk to him for the story, but he is still around.
He's still around, huh? He was floating in and out of homelessness, was living in a garage apartment up in Hyde Park for a while, but that's many years ago. So I don't know what's become of him. Anyway, moving on to the millennium here, we've got now our generalized bans on camping, bans on panhandling, even lying down in public. We've got benches in downtown Austin that no longer permit somebody to lie prone on the bench. You know, they've got armrests strategically positioned, you know, which surely must have been designed with the homeless in mind.
Hostile architecture, I think, is what it's called. And yeah, clearly intended to reduce the places that, you know, people living on the streets have, as Gus put it, like do unavoidable behaviors like sleeping.
Right. Yeah. Who needs to do that? You know, well, all this leads us up to a rather dramatic climax of last June. Austin, you want to comment on that? Just what happened in June of last year?
Yeah. So I guess it was June 20th, 2019, somewhere around there. City Council voted 9-2 to loosen these three ordinances that regulate behaviors of people on the streets, you know, sitting and lying. Public camping has been the one that's gotten the most attention, but also panhandling ordinance was changed to prohibit, I think it's aggressive solicitation is the phrase used now. And it was a major victory for justice for people living on the streets. And it's interesting looking back, I remember talking with several council members at the time, some who even ended up voting for it, that were very hesitant about doing so. Obviously, they were anticipating some of the backlash that followed. And I remember especially one thing that came up repeatedly, the state of Colorado had recently had a statewide ballot referendum attempting to repeal their state laws prohibiting public camping. And that initiative went down in flames, like 40 points, I think they lost by. So I had several council members pointing that out and kind of saying, you know, we're taking a big risk here. But Greg Kassar, to his credit, he championed this issue and really took it on, became the public face of it. They ended up loosening those ordinances, which the detractors, the conservative groups, will try and portray it as this terrible thing that Austin's leaders have done. But if you talk to outreach workers, people, you know, working to end homelessness, people experiencing homelessness themselves, almost universally, you hear that this was a good thing for people in this situation. So I think we're beginning to see some of that a year and a half or so later.
Was there a little bit of backtracking from the June ordinance later last summer?
This is another interesting thing, is that annually the city council, they take a break in July, a kind of a summer break where they don't meet. And council last June, they loosened these ordinances at their last meeting before that break, which is really seen now as a misstep. I think even Craig Kassar has told me as much, that, you know, they should have stuck around more. And not that any of them went on vacation or anything. They were holding town halls and answering to constituents and continuing to work on the policy, but they were not meeting to vote on things for all of July. And I think finally in October, they voted on amended versions of the ordinances that kind of restricted behaviors slightly more, but certainly nowhere to the level that they were before June of last year.
Got it. Now, in the meantime, though, the police were not exactly on board with any of this, right?
There was a lot of feet dragging from Chief Brian Manley, the department. They were not being as cooperative as they could have been in trying to enact the council's vision. I remember at one point there was debate about if someone's camping on a sidewalk, there needs to be 5 feet of space between, you know, the person and the sidewalk to allow people to walk through. And Chief Manley kind of, I think disingenuously, had said, you know, something to the effect of, do we expect police officers to be out there with a measuring tape to make sure that there's 5 feet of space between the on the sidewalk? And of course not. No. So there was a lot of that happening, a lot of reluctance to kind of engage cooperatively with the council, which is, you know, really a pattern with this police chief. So that certainly didn't make things easier for the council members who voted for the changes.
Well, then, Gus, I think about that time, then it seemed like war began to break out between the city of Austin and the state of Texas. We had the governor open up, they're calling it Camp Abbott there in Montopolis, and there were some other measures. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Before I touch on that, I just wanted to say that, you know, I think that to some extent, you know, the numbers tell the story on these policies, and we had seen various reporters obtained data on the citations under these ordinances for the last 5-6 years. But finally, after wrangling with the municipal and downtown Austin court, I was able to get it back to 2000. And there, so you get a pool of over 50,000 citations, and 75% became warrants, right? Hmm. So if this is supposed to be a sort of functional system of punishment for a behavior, or it's supposed to be a system that's connecting people to services, I just don't see how you make that case when you got 75% of these tickets are resulting in a warrant, you know, unless the sort of secret purpose of these policies is just to make homeless people arrestable at will, right? So that when someone's calling the police and they're irate, the police officer can pretend to do something, essentially. They're not actually addressing the person's housing issue, but they can go ahead and arrest them and take them away. And that person feels like the police are listening, because that's a lot of the grief, or a lot of the sort of heat coming from the anti-homeless side, is, or what I interpret it as, is they feel like they can't just call the cops and have someone taken away anymore. That's the vibe I get off of a lot of it. Obviously, that didn't solve the underlying problem before. It doesn't now. So it's really hard to sort of make a fact-based case for this unless you're going to admit a somewhat more nefarious purpose, in my opinion. And secondly, to your question, certainly the governor reacted both through Twitter and to some extent the deployment of state agencies to both make unhoused folks a bit harder in Austin, their lives a bit harder in Austin, and to whip up anti-homeless sentiment, which was obviously sort of a proxy for whipping up sentiment against liberal Austin and liberal Austin leaders. And when COVID hit, the governor relaxed, I suppose. He's not tweeting about this issue anymore, but the things that I wanted to point to now are, we still might see something in the legislative session. It's hard to say because they have a budgetary crisis and et cetera to deal with now. We might see something in the legislative session. And also something that kind of flew under the radar, Leander passed a camping ban recently. That doesn't affect very many people, but it's just kind of an interesting little data point, I thought.
Yeah.
Can I add something? I was appreciative that, Gus, you tracked down those citation numbers, because that was something that I think has gotten kind of lost since the ordinances were loosened. But the Homes Not Handcuffs Coalition, who was the main advocacy group behind that effort, part of their reasoning for loosening the ordinances was for this reason, to prevent the issuance of citations, not just because it unduly burdened people experiencing homelessness and created fines that they wouldn't be able to pay that could turn into warrants for arrest, but those warrants can actually make it harder for someone to end their homelessness. ECHO, the lead agency in Austin Travis County on homeless services, put out a report in 2017 or 18 where they surveyed like 100 different apartment management groups in Austin and found that most of them have policies that allow them to deny someone housing if they have a warrant out for their arrest. Not an actual arrest, not a conviction, but just a warrant. So the fact that these tickets, which, as Gus says, have the effect of shuffling people around, were actually preventing people from getting off the streets, from attaining housing, which was, you know, a motivating factor in loosening those ordinances.
We're speaking with Gus Bova and Austin Sanders about homelessness in Austin. Once again, thank you to all of our supporters. The fall membership drive has kept us on the air, all due to your efforts. In case you missed it, you can go to our website, koop.org, and click the donate button. And be assured of our gratitude to you, our partners, for 25 years of community radio in Austin. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on October 8th. We're speaking with Gus Bova and Austin Sanders about homelessness in Austin. Before the break, we heard Phil Collins' classic, Another Day in Paradise. Let's continue. Did you want to say any more about the state facility in Montopolis, for example, and the crackdown from the governor?
I'm curious, Austin, have you done any reporting out there since the Other Ones Foundation got set up out there?
No, I was just going to say that I saw that they moved out there, which is a really positive step forward, because basically since Camp Abbott, Camp Rad has had a few different names, has been set up, I haven't heard any positive stories coming from it. It is really kind of a political move by Abbott, I think, to do something that city staff did their research and said, this is a bad idea. You shouldn't set up this kind of camp. It doesn't, in the long run, help reduce unsheltered homelessness. But it's something that the Chamber of Commerce and business types, conservatives, really like, primarily because it kind of concentrates unhoused people away from downtown, the business, central business sector. So it was something that Abbott could do to say, look, the state coming in and solving liberal Austin's problems, but it really hasn't done that. So I saw that the Other Ones Foundation, which is really one of the premier outreach organizations in town, they do a lot of good work. Unlike some other service providers, when everyone else shut down in March during the pandemic, they were still out there meeting their people and providing much needed food and services. So I really applaud their effort. So it's encouraging to see that they're out there, but I haven't touched in with any of the folks I know there to help turn things around there.
Basically, until they set up out there, you had a camp that, I mean, it had its good sides and bad sides, but there was, I think, more to criticize than laud overall. You know, it was so remote and, you know, the city ended up having to figure out bus service and then that helped, right? And the food service was very inconsistent for a very long time. I mean, the state would provide a sort of minimum supply of military type rations, but the sort of volunteer charitable feeding operation would just kind of come and go. It wasn't consistent day to day, and no electricity. They're living in, well, not everyone actually. Now the whole property's full up with tents, but at first they were setting up in these little vehicle bays, which I can't even imagine in July. I mean, it'd be an oven, honestly. Mm-hmm. But this is all pre the other one's foundation going out there. So things may be improving quite a bit.
Jim, from a legal perspective, what's your take on the police response to the homeless?
Well, you know, you have that First Amendment issue, of course, is always here, but is probably more disrespected in practice than in other First Amendment instances. I was struck by the stats on the criminalization of homelessness and the 75% that are turned into warrants. I was wondering why there hasn't been any litigation attacking. It's been very clear in earlier Supreme Court decisions that can't penalize people for being poor.
This was also a motivating factor for the council and advocates' fear of potential litigation, because there had been a ruling, I think in the Ninth Circuit, I can't remember which city, Boise, I think, that had overturned their camping bans and ruled them unconstitutional. Basically, the ruling found that if a city or county's homelessness response system does not have enough shelter beds to provide to the number of people experiencing homelessness, then it's unconstitutional to prohibit someone from sleeping in the street or in public space, because where else are they supposed to do it if they don't have a shelter to go to? And that is certainly the case in Austin. There's something like 1,200, I think, housing beds. I don't remember the exact number. And the last point in time count found like 2,600 people experiencing homelessness. So that was something that some council members certainly cited, is this fear of potential litigation if the ordinance weren't amended.
You know, I went out to Camp Abbott a couple of times during the summer, and it was just awful, absolutely awful. It was almost cynical, you know, the way that was set up, you know, the way that where people were put and how they were treated. And I think it's something that people ought to see, you know, because putting it in Metropolis, of course, was calculated. Put it in a very poor Hispanic area,
yeah,
with very little access. You know, when you read about it or you hear about it in the paper and the press, it seems like something's, you know, good is going on, at least in, maybe unsatisfactory. But when you actually see what this was, you know, just concrete, essentially old rundown buildings,
yeah,
it was awful. The other thing that struck me about this conversation is language. Depending on how we talk about this, I hear you guys talking about unsheltered. That, I think, is very interesting to me, that how we can focus our understanding of this by changing some of the language that we've traditionally used in dealing with people who are unsheltered, right? Who are out on the streets. So it's interesting. I commend both of you for your work. It's really fascinating and good and important.
Yeah, once again, Gus, that was just an amazing piece that you wrote there, you know, and do appreciate all your coverage of this too, Austin, you know, both you guys. Thinking ahead a little bit here, the city is in the process of purchasing some properties, right?
Yeah, that's right. Their strategy is shifting on reducing the number of unsheltered people experiencing homelessness. It is shifting since last year and the arrival of Matt Malika as the director of ECHO, shifting toward this strategy where they are essentially going to buy up motels and hotels across the city and convert them into permanent supportive housing facilities. I mean, there's a number of reasons they're taking this approach, but primarily it's because permanent supportive housing is the best way to stabilize someone's housing status, to get them housed and then support them with wraparound services to help attain a job, get healthcare, mental health care, whatever it may be, to kind of address the issues that are unique, individualized to each person, but address those issues that can contribute to homelessness.
I mean, I just want to add that, I mean, there's nothing I can do about this. Many people are going to look to their city government and praise or blame them for the degree of homelessness and visible homelessness in their community. And certainly the city has a lot of responsibilities there, can and should do more. Austin already is dedicating a lot more money to the problem than they used to, a lot more money than Dallas. I just saw their budget was approved recently. But frankly, this isn't a problem that individual cities solve, in my view. I mean, I've only been closely studying the issue for a little over a year, but it seems pretty clear to me that this requires a coordinated approach with a lot of
federal investment and federal policy changes. And I don't think I can reach everyone and convince them, but I would honestly say that if you are expecting this to be solved at the city by city level, it's an unrealistic expectation.
Hmm. Yeah,
I think.
It's interesting too, just this strategy of buying up old hotels with the current economic crisis we're in, and given all of the hotels available in this town right now, I have a feeling there's going to be no shortage of motels and hotels that are currently unoccupied by the convention business here.
I think we're already seeing that this model is successful. So I think it was like last fall when the city first closed on their first motel or Roadway Inn in Southeast Austin. And they still haven't like opened that technically. They're rehabilitating it still and preparing it. But the pandemic kind of forced the city to move much more rapidly in this direction. And they set up these pro lodges is what they're called, where people can come off the street and kind of get temporary housing and then maybe connected with a case manager and a housing program manager to work on more longer term solutions. But the outreach workers I talked to are just completely impressed with the way that these pro lodges, which are in a way pilot programs for the pilot versions of the broader motel strategy, they've just been totally impressed with how well these facilities have been run, which these are people who are not typically impressed with the way that some agencies run these types of programs. So I think it is an encouraging sign for the progress the city can make. Gus is certainly right that cities can't solve this problem on their own. The factors that lead to homelessness are expansive and include more than just ability to afford rent or housing. But this task force report that came out earlier this month suggests that if the city just invested $20 million annually in the operation of these types of facilities, they could dramatically reduce the amount of unsheltered homelessness, which is, you know, it's not a lot of money for a city that has $1 billion plus budget. So I think it's feasible, if not completely ending the crisis, but certainly impacting it and improving the lives of hundreds of people.
I'm curious, not to put you on the spot or anything, but did the report, how did it calculate, you know, the rate of people becoming newly homeless? You know what I mean? Like, especially given how much it could jump as a result of the current economic crisis.
The report was issued, man, when did it come out? I want to say it was after the shutdown, but I don't think most of their calculations factored in the like recession we were heading into or like, you know, had just dropped into. And I don't remember exactly how they calculated how the numbers of unsheltered people would continue to rise. But I think the idea is if you can expand the existing system, because I know they do have charts that show, and this may be from the point in time count actually, that like the rate of homelessness from the point in time counts over the past like 10 years or so has kept about a pace with population growth within the city and county. And that's with a fledgling response system. That's with an inadequate response system. So I think the thinking is if the system could be grown to a size that could actually help the amount of people experiencing homelessness now, and that trend of newly unsheltered people continues to rise along the same pace as population growth, the problem becomes manageable. Of course, the pandemic and the recession could totally change all of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll double check that report. Maybe I should be less pessimistic than I am, but just to give a like concrete federal example, you know, if you take the Section 8 voucher program and if you just made it what's called an entitlement program so that everyone who qualifies for Section 8 gets it, I mean, homelessness would be dramatically slashed very quickly. And that kind of change is just something that can't happen on a city by city level. But I don't want to be too pessimistic either about what Austin can do.
Yeah. You know, before we were talking about opposition groups that have been forming over the years, there's one that's particularly active right now. And that's this, is it Save Austin Now? Is that the name of the organization?
Yeah. And they've kind of receded into the background. They were driving this petition effort to put, you know, criminalization of homelessness on the ballot to a citywide vote to basically put these, the three ordinances back to their pre-2019 versions. And they failed to gather enough signatures to make it on the ballot. And since then, they've transformed into a different group that's now like endorsing city council candidates, but it's the same people just under a new name. But yeah, they kind of failed at that effort, which, you know, cynically was likely just a way to drive turnout. You know, they know the Republican Party here knows that they have a president who, outside of his core base, there are not too many independent or other Republican voters are too enthusiastic to vote for him. But it would have been something to vote on the public camping ban, could have drawn out conservative voters a little more, and that failed. And so they're now kind of, you know, repositioning again and getting involved in some city council races.
Whatever happened, I there was a lot of promises that they would, sue the city clerk or something, or do something.
Yeah.
Have you heard?
Yeah, you know, when I saw Matt Makowiak, who's the chair of the Travis County Republican Party, had said that, I started calling around to a few attorneys that I know who would probably relish the opportunity to sue the city. And none of them like had talked with Matt or said that they weren't involved. And Matt won't respond to my emails anymore. So I don't know. I don't know what's happening there, but we certainly haven't seen any progress on that front.
Sorry.
I kind of celebrated when Save Austin Now lost their petition effort, and he kind of blocked me on Twitter and told me don't email him anymore. So,
hey, Gus, we've been hopping all over the place here, but one thing I want to make sure we talk a little about is just some of your reporting from on the scenes, you know, going out to Texas 71, for example, and other underpasses. And I know this morning, just driving back from 5501 airport there, I saw tents all over the place, you know, and I was just thinking, have those always been there, you know, or is this growing? I don't know, but there just seems to be more tents out there now.
I cannot say with certainty whether there are more unsheltered, unhoused people in Austin now than there were a year and a half ago, but it's pretty indisputable that they're more visible because of one, being in places that you see when you're driving by, like under an overpass, as opposed to sort of little nooks and crannies and wooded areas. And second, the tents. There definitely weren't as many tents before because it wasn't legal to have a tent. What I would say is that yes, like a city can, you know, have some regulation and rules about where people can camp or not. You know, I don't think anyone would say Austin needs to allow people to set up a tent right in front of the door to the public library, right? Or inside someone's home. And in fact, that's not what the current rules allow, right? So sure, there is a give and take here. And I understand people who maybe occasionally feel that they're being infringed upon in some way. But what I don't think enough people take the time to think about is what it looks like from the other perspective and what it looks like from the other side and how nice it is to have a tent that gives you a little bit of privacy, that gives you a little bit of protection from the elements. I think people are very confused about why people go to those underpasses. And there's a number of reasons. It has to do with getting away from bugs, getting away from poison ivy, getting into a place where you feel like you have good visibility. Also, there's a breeze, actually. So during the summer, there's kind of a breeze under the underpasses. Rain protection. People are not behaving irrationally, you know what I mean? And you have to, at minimum, take into account that perspective and balance it against whatever other concerns there might be. I mean, that's the bare minimum. And then secondly, I personally tend to have a little more empathy for the person in dire poverty than the person feeling an inconvenience, right? But
Gus, I'm sure you've heard this from people, unsheltered people you've interviewed. I know I've heard, you know, several times some version of, I'm not going back to the woods, which is to say, loosening these ordinances have allowed people who once were pushed off to the fringes of society because the visibility of extreme poverty is uncomfortable for most people. I feel a sense of shame when I see people living in tents because they have nowhere else to go. And I think, you know, that's a natural reaction. And allowing people to move out of the fringe of society has so many benefits, which again was another motivation for loosening these ordinances. And the people that have been allowed to do that, there's a sense that, you know, in the conversations I've had, that they don't want to go back to the way that things were, where they were less safe, have less access to jobs and services, were harder to track down by their case managers and things of that nature. So I think that's worth pointing out as well.
I just want to second that too, Austin. You know, when I was talking about all the tents and that, it wasn't so much as an eyesore as to just, geez, the magnitude of this problem just seems to be getting worse, you know?
And sometimes when a camp becomes, you know, completely strewn with trash and things, I would say it's fair to say that it's an eyesore. That's where you get to the question of how can volunteer groups and the city, in my opinion, how can they sort of cooperatively help those folks keep their spaces clean? And some progress was made on that during the pandemic because hand washing stations and porta potties were finally provided to a number of camps. The state has stopped doing their cleanups and the city is resuming theirs. And from what I can tell, the city is taking some of this feedback from council and the activist groups and trying to push in a more sort of cooperative direction with those cleanups. But of course, it's all done through contractors and stuff, and it's a little hard to get your head around every instance. There's a group called Stop the Sweeps that does a lot of on-the-ground documentation of this stuff.
At a recent meeting where council was renewing the contract for Relief Enterprises, I think is the group now that's doing the sweeps, Councilmember Kassar was trying to push staff at Austin Resource Recovery and Public Works to bring this work in-house. Don't contract it out as much so the city can have more oversight over how it's conducted. Staff was kind of resistant to it. You know, they were not really on board. I think that could change. They're still looking at ways to bring some of that work in-house, but the sweeps have definitely been a problem. And I really got to applaud groups like Stop the Sweeps who have been really tracking the injustices carried out there since, you know, before November, even when Governor Abbott started doing the state sweeps.
Yeah,
exactly. And I do think you're right. I think ARR may be taking on some additional responsibilities there. That's kind of in the weeds. The broad point is, for me, the broad point is that there are conflicting interests here, conflicting points of view. Public space is bound to be a site where there's people wanting to use it in different ways. But this is a population that deserves empathy, is a part and a product of our society, not outside of our society. You hear people say things like, citizens are having to live next to the homeless, as if they weren't citizens or residents just as much as anyone else, right? And I mean, really, like, you got to see these as people experiencing dire poverty. Kassar put it well for my story. He said, basically, like, this was an issue of sort of basic civil rights for the unhoused. So, and I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one more class of other, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're drawing close to our end here. If you have any concluding thoughts you want to add in, anybody?
Yeah, I guess one thing I'll say is, you know, we kind of talked about what effect decriminalizing homelessness could have. And I think we've seen some immediate positive outcomes, but I think the longer term outcomes that advocates are hoping for are not going to be realized for some time. The work of ending homelessness for an individual is long-term work. It doesn't just happen when they get placed into a housing program, right? It's sometimes undoing a lifetime of trauma, a decade or more of living on the street, and really reacclimating to, you know, functioning inside of some societal aspects. So I think it's important for people to understand that, like, we may see tents for several more years, you know, more than we would like to see, but that doesn't mean that progress is not being made on reducing homelessness. It's just a complicated problem that takes time to address successfully.
Yeah, I agree. I think I got my my closing statement in already.
Okay. And Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I certainly agree. This is a long-term problem and not helpful to look at it short-term. I think this really has to be viewed that way and planned that way, you know, in terms of where we end up and where we want to go as a society.
Well, I really appreciate everybody's contribution here today. This has been, I feel blessed that we've had probably the two reporters that have been most on top of this joining us here on Co-op. Many, many thanks to both of you and to Jim as always. We'll revisit this again soon. We've had this topic on a couple times this year. And like you said, it's a long-term project. I think we'll have to come back and see what kind of progress is made. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. You know, the great thing about your show is you don't have to just do a little soundbite about your work. You can actually get into some of the layers of it. So I appreciate what you do, Bob.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's always good talking with you. Thanks for inviting me on again.
Austin, we'll get you back on with some City Hall updates again soon, too, I hope so.
Yeah, we got to talk about these hotel taxes, man. It's exciting stuff.
It's Friday evening, October 9th. We have time for just a quick report from Michelle Manning Scott. Things have been kind of busy out there at 5501 Airport, I hear.
They have been. Things are picking up for sure.
You're handling mail-in ballots that people can drop off in person, right?
Correct.
I actually did that yesterday.
It was great to see you finally in person again for the first time in months.
I can tell you the process is very simple. I went in there masked up. I think that's how they prefer. You kind of wend your way through the parking lot, just follow all the cones and the people waving at you. And eventually you wind up at one of eight positions where they will ask for your driver's license or ID, ask you to sign a log and take your ballot from you, and they will deposit it in the ballot box right in front of you.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what all the clerks are there to do.
Even though you're really busy, I was in and out of there in, you know, just a matter of minutes. You were mentioning that they think they've mailed out 68,000 mail-in ballots now.
Yeah, they are at just over 68,000, and they had another 6,000 that they were hoping to finish up by sometime tomorrow at the latest to get in the mail.
So tell us a little about the schedule then, starting on Tuesday the 13th when we air.
The hours will switch to 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Saturday, and then Sundays it will be open from noon to 6 p.m. And that's through Friday, October 30th. And after that, they will remain open through Election Day, aside from Election Day, which will definitely be the same hours the regular polls are open, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The hours between that, so October 31st through November 2nd, the hours are still yet to be determined. And then the polls to go and vote, of course, are open for early voting starting on the 13th, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Saturday. And then Sunday, again, from noon to 6 p.m. All the information about where you can go to vote in person at a poll can be found at votetravis.com.
Well, again, thank you so much for your service, Michelle. Keep up the good work.
Sounds good. You take care, Bob. It's good to hear from you. Good to talk to you.
And a quick postscript on Saturday, October 10th. The Texas Tribune reports U.S. District Judge Robert Pittman ruled Friday that Texas counties can have multiple drop-off locations for absentee ballots heading into the November 3rd general election, blocking the enforcement of Governor Greg Abbott's recent order that sought to limit counties to just one such location. Pittman said that Abbott's order confused voters and restricted voter access. Prior to Friday's ruling, Democrats had denounced Abbott's order, labeling it voter suppression. Well, that's all for this evening. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe.